2 weeks before you get the second shot, and then another 2 weeks before, you know, to let everything settle in your body and make sure, you know, take after that second shot. So that comes out to 5 weeks. Right. Am I right?
Well, I agree with Ed. Likewise, that is your peak immunity offered by the vaccination. The first shot will slowly give you a good immune ability to fight it off. Not a great one. The second will improve upon it greatly, and it sort of reaches its maximum around 2 weeks after your second booster. Theoretically, you can continue to wear the mask as long as you would like to continue to wear the mask. As we mentioned earlier, taking the vaccine doesn't definitively protect you from ever becoming infectious to other people. So for the sake of other people who haven't had the vaccine, you might still want to wear the vaccine in front of them. But that's up to you and the changing rules of the FDA, the CDC, and the transportation department, even.
They didn't comment. You mean you want to wear the mask in front of them, just like the vaccine?
Oh, sorry. I transposed. Yes, I did indeed mean wear the mask. It would be rather silly to wear the vaccine.
I gotta try that.
Hey, Roy, I missed what Ed said when I unkeyed. What did Ed say?
Ed just corrected me that I transposed the word and I used the vaccine instead of the mask when I was mentioning that you can go on wearing the mask in future if you want to protect other people from becoming infected. Once you're vaccinated, you can still become infectious to other people, even though your chances of becoming particularly symptomatic are far lower.
Very good. W.S. Twan listening.
I also heard today that they're saying, even if you're fully vaccinated, don't throw the mask away. When things get crowded, put a mask on.
Well, yeah, like I said before, unfortunately, this is all going to be subject to change because it really, it depends upon the variant. New variants can pop into existence. It depends upon the number of people who continue to be non-vaccinated, and they are still a large pool of possible infections. And again, because we've been vaccinated may mean that we have a very, very small chance of getting terribly ill, but there is still a non-zero chance of being able to infect other people who then go on to be terribly ill. So there's a lot of variables up in the air, things that are subject to change and adjustments. So I would not be at all surprised, as you hear recently, different authorities are issuing contradictory mask rules. This will probably continue into the winter time.
K2JX, so I have one additional query.
Yes, Joe, certainly. Joe, you can ask your question.
2 weeks. I've been hearing something about research involving an oral type of, an oral kind of vaccination, but an oral type of administration. I don't know if it's in the form of a liquid or if it's a form of, it's taken orally. It's similar to that which you have both coming in from Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. And I'm just wondering if you're familiar with that at all. I don't know who the manufacturer is. I think I heard it might be coming out of Israel, but I'm not sure. I'm just wondering if anyone has heard of that. Again, you take it orally, as opposed to taking it as a direct injection.
Okay, I have not heard of that. Oral vaccines tend to be attenuated live vaccines. So I guess theoretically, something like the adenovirus might be able to be modified so that you could give it like the polio Sabin vaccine, which was a live attenuated vaccine. So that's possible. The only time when I looked for something along those lines, the only thing I could find at the time was actually for an antiviral that's going through phase 1 and phase 2 research to be a treatment, an actual treatment for the COVID-19 virus, not a orally administered vaccine. But, you know, they could be, I'm sure they're working on all kinds of interesting things out there.
I did see something on that this morning, collaborate.
Yeah, certainly, yes.
I think several foreign countries are working on their own domestically produced vaccines, and they've been able to, they've been given some formulas and the like of what the current vaccines are to work with. And I think they said Japan had a group that was developing an oral vaccine, and they showed a picture, but it looked like a little card with some gel caps, like allergy medications or something, but that's all they said about it, that they're toying with developing a oral version of the vaccine, and it's just a picture of what looked like an over-the-counter card with gel caps.
Okay, thanks to the miracle of Google, I Googled it, and there's a Forbes article from a couple days ago about trials in Israel. Yeah, it's probably going to look very strange. I mean, if you were, if you ever saw anyone get the Sabin oral vaccine, it was on a sugar cube. So it's a slightly different way of, because you're giving a, as I said, you're usually giving a weakened strain of live virus. So it's on curious objects. It's not the, you know, quite what we're used to as far as medicine is concerned. Apparently, it's being developed by an Israeli company, I think, called Oravax. It's a joint venture between the Israelis and the Americans. And apparently, there's something going on with an Indian company called Aramed as well.
You mentioned Sabin vaccine. You want to hear my comments?
Sure, Ed. I have a little story about the Sabin vaccine as well, but please, go ahead.
Sabin vaccines and sugar are for wusses. I had 4 injections 1 week apart in the elementary school library.
So you had the soft vaccine that preluded the Sabin vaccine.
Yes. When I was in the 3rd grade, we were the guinea pigs that it was tested on. 4 injections 1 week apart in the school laboratory kind of reminded me. When I saw movies about GIs and boot camp, I said, hey, been there, done that.
Okay, I don't think I've talked to a person who mentioned that they actually did have the stork vaccine. The soft vaccine used dead viruses. They would fix it, I don't know, I think maybe formaldehyde, but in some way they would kill the polio virus and then inject it. The problem with dead virus vaccines is that the immune capability is not as good and doesn't last as long as live attenuated. So a few years later, when Sabin developed his own live attenuated, that became the major polio vaccine. It's very good for, you know, in building in a good immune status and for long-term immunity. The problem, though, is since it was an attenuated virus, about 1 out of 1 million cases, the attenuated virus spontaneously mutated back to something very similar as the original virulent one. So out of every 1 million kids, some would come down with polio-like symptoms. So that was the bad part of that. Once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone else has any comments, questions, or answers, now's the time to offer them. Hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, unfortunately, whoever that was about 90% noise, 10% voice. So I could hear someone trying to say something, but I couldn't hear a word you said. So if you can raise the gain or wiggle the antenna or check the connectors. And try again.
This is KD2NVB. I hope it's better now. I went from 40% to 100% power. Yeah, another recent COVID development, vaccine development question.
Yeah, certainly, Bob. Now I can understand every word you said.
Great. Yeah, I guess the antenna's not as good as yesterday. I used to be able to do it on that power level. Anyway, yeah, about the recent article I just read today in the New York Times about, you know, the even Biden administration is talking about, you know, third booster shot, and also some studies that I guess not totally conclusive yet, but that maybe the Pfizer vaccine is starting to get less powerful after 6 months or something. So what do you have to, what you have to say about that? Thank you, Roy.
Okay, I just want to caution you a little bit. While you were talking, there was a beep that was interpolated in your transmission, so I hope your radio isn't giving up any kind of overheating alarm from the high power, but just want you to be aware. I have followed this interesting soap opera. Pfizer originally announced months ago that they were going to be working on modified boosters that included the mutations of such things as the Delta variant. Then about a month ago, there was another different report from Pfizer that they were going to seek approval from the Food and Drug Administration in August for a third shot of the same exact Pfizer shot that are given already in two, you know, an initial and a booster. So this approval to the Food and Drug Administration is not for anything new, but for the same exact vaccine to be given as a booster. When they did this, a bunch of virologists and epidemiologists and other people researching the field did not feel as though there was any real good demonstration that the immune status of vaccinated people was going down that quickly. In fact, I think I mentioned a few months ago that although generally once you are vaccinated, you initially have a high concentration of antibodies in your bloodstream, but the way the immune system works is over time, those get less and less and less. But if you maintain a group of memory cells, white blood cells that remember exactly what the virus looks like and is able to produce antibodies very rapidly overnight for any sign of infection. So even though serology levels of antibodies may go down, that does not necessarily mean that anyone's immune status has gone down. So there's going to be a little bit of an argument soon. The Food and Drug Administration may generally give emergency approval for a third booster, but not issue any recommendations one way or the other, and then it will be a squabble between some drug companies and some epidemiologists and virologists. So it's up in the air. I have not seen any particularly proven thing about the immunological, the lack of immune status. Apparently, Pfizer has something inside their own laboratories, which are, you know, dubious. But hopefully they'll share them with the rest of us and we can assess it accurately.
So I guess if possible, I mean, some people are going to say this anyway, they're just trying to make a few extra bucks to push another vaccine. And, yeah, you would think the scientists would all know what you know there. I mean, I've heard you say that, and I've heard other people say that about this. Yeah, but anyways, I'm there, but it doesn't mean it's less effective. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, supposedly Pfizer seems to be indicating this from a bunch of unpublished studies that they have not released yet. So is it possible that this is real? Is it possible that it's financial? Is it possible that it's someplace in the middle? Only time and a couple of really good books will tell us.
Yeah, okay, so I guess it's still, the jury's out at this point, I guess.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, like I said before, the book really hasn't been published yet. This adventure continues. And there's going to be a couple little surprises like anything M. Night Shyamalan would write. So we don't know. We don't know how many more peaks there will be, whether there'll be micro peaks, mini peaks, or full-size peaks. I live in fear that some place with a big turnover of viral infections like Brazil or India or some other place that isn't fessing up to the fact that their citizens are dying, it will be a breeding spot for variations on the Delta variant, something really nasty. I don't want to hear about an epsilon or anything higher, but it's possible. So this book hasn't been written. It's still possible to have a lousy ending. I hope not. I think we're on the right road, and again, if we could just smack our neighbors' heads a little bit lightly, not to damage them, but just to knock some sense into them, and please, you know, get your loved ones, your friends, and even your enemies vaccinated. If anything, that's my slogan for the last 18 months.
Okay, good evening. Yeah, I hear you, Roy. Yeah, I'm still worried about, I'm a musician, and I just started playing this steady Saturday gig that, you know, ended before the pandemic. We play three of them now every Saturday, and we're in a crowded bar. Before, by and large, not wearing masks. And, of course, I'm sitting here playing a wind instrument in a band next to other people doing the same. And I'm a little worried, because I'm worried about even getting a mild case of COVID, because all this talk of long-haul systems and, you know, that still, I guess, the flu is still very little. I'm going to learn a lot more about that in the future. But if you possibly have mild symptoms, there might be some long-term effects. So I'm worried about that, too.
Well, I mean, that's understandable. Again, we don't know. You know, I would not at all be surprised if over the next, say, 20 years, there are a lot of papers written of a whole bunch of syndromes that haven't been named yet for people who got through the infection either with non-fatal or minimal symptoms and developed respiratory long-term problems, or coronary long-term problems, or renal long-term problems. There's been very little research released about long-haul problems in the vaccinated community, whether that's a thing or not a thing, or whether it's not been proven to be a thing for the short haul, but we have to wait you know, some more time to see what develops. So, you know, life is somewhat dangerous, no matter what you do. The best that you could do is be smart about it, and be safe, and not let fear just drive you, and the belief that someone is out to get us all. Because usually we're the people out to get us, not other people. So you just have to be smart about it. But yeah, it's scary times. I mean, I remember, you know, back in January when I was just telling people about this as it was growing in Wuhan. And, you know, the people would ask me, well, the infections rate is rather large. Isn't that going to kind of be a problem? And I think I said, yeah, but, you know, it's been a bad adventure, and I hope it ends real soon.
NBD. Oh, thank you, Roy. Yeah. It's something I'll have to work out with myself. You know, find a something I'm comfortable with and hope it works out okay. And I'll keep my ear to the ground and my eye on the news and see what develops. Thanks. Back to you. We continue.
Okay. Very good, Bob. Thanks for participating. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2, Gulf Sierra. Name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. Any other questions or comments for the night? We still have a little bit of time, so if you have any questions, either amateur radio related or general science questions or general medical questions, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Bob, WA2MHL, question.
Yes, Bob. why can't the government mandate that you must take the vaccine? I don't quite understand.
It's a free country.
Or something.
Okay, as a gentleman who fails to ID himself, which is an FCC violation in itself, mentioned that it's a free country, but I guess he feels that it's free enough that you can violate FCC rules as well. There is a perpetual dance to the death that people have between public health issues and a private freedom. This has gone repeatedly to the Supreme Court, and at this point I'm considering the possibility that they're using tossing a coin as their way of figuring these things out. There's all kinds of public health issues. Can you stop people congregating? A lot of people congregate for specious reasons of watching sports, but others do it for the sake of God. They meet together in prayer, and they don't want a government telling them they can't do that. Those things inevitably end up in Supreme Court. Being vaccinated against your will is a big freedom versus public health issue. It would land in the Supreme Court and generate a lot of negative publicity and cause people to kind of overreact on the other end. I think it would serve a purpose against vaccinating more than for vaccinating. So that's why you don't hear anyone sane in the government suggesting things like that. It's sort of like someone in the government saying, you know, on second thought, let's take everyone's guns away. You know, it's political suicide. So I think that's my feeling as far as why you're not going to hear any politicians do that.
KG2VHD.
On that question, when I was in the Navy quite some time ago, but there was no question. You didn't question whether or not you were going to take the shots or not. They just said, stick out your arm and you got them.
Same thing happened to my son in the Navy much more recently.
Okay, Bob and Ed, I agree with you. The thing, though, is that when you join the armed forces, to a degree, you give away a lot of your constitutional rights and privileges. So they can get away with it a lot easier in the armed forces than they can out there in the general public. I agree with you that if we were all in the military, our commanding officer could order it, and if we didn't want it, we would be put in jail.
82VHD.
Yes, Jim.
It's been a great conversation. I wanted to just throw in a little thought. Doesn't solve anything, just gives me something to think about. As we ponder these questions, one question that should be on our mind is, who owns you? Over.
Okay. I am sure there are many people who have many wonderful, delightful ideas of who owns me, ranging from politicians to billionaires to lizard people to aliens to spirit worlds and to people, to things, I won't say people, to creatures that live in the center of the earth.
No, my wife owns me lock, stock, and barrel.
That's probably the root of us, Ed. No, I didn't mean in a personal level to you, just in a general level, you know. Each of us has to answer that question for ourselves, I think.
I guess so. Ultimately, I don't think, I don't sort of believe in the Illuminati, that there's a group of people who've already taken over everything. I think there's a bunch of people with power and a bunch of people with money and a bunch of people with brains who kind of keep pulling and pushing on the strings and get some things done and not other things in a kind of messy sort of way. I find it not a comfortable theory that there's a group of guys that meet someplace in Europe twice a year and decide on who's going to win the World Series and everything else that happens. They did a great version of that on X-Files back in the old days, by the way.
I guess my thought was really referring to the fact, shouldn't the government just tell you have to do something? And every time, there's a valid reason to ask that question, but it should be considered amongst thought of who owns each of us, you know. So it doesn't make the problem easier to solve, it just makes it more interesting.
Okay, but you know, it depends on what street you go down on that, because you could end up in La La Land. I think most of us don't think that the government runs us, that it's supposed to be the other way around, and unfortunately, the government doesn't understand that. You know, it's kind of the old joke where you get stopped by a police officer for a speed violation, and you decide to go on the line of, officer, I pay your salary, so obey me and let me go, which I've never heard to actually work. But nevertheless, there are feedback mechanisms where if the population is really unhappy to a significant degree, eventually they make their unhappiness known. So I don't think anyone owns anyone else lock, stock, and barrel 100%. I think it's something that kind of ebbs and flows like the tide. But that's my own personal way of looking on things.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more. KD2VHD on the side. Good conversation. Good to hear it on the radio.
You're welcome. I kind of like that this... This technical net is an opportunity to have discourses on a whole series of subjects. A week or so ago, I was having a discussion just checking out my antenna setup with a gentleman about neurolinguistics. And I told him he should check out the tech net because you never know when we'll fall into a conversation about neurolinguistics. But I enjoy these conversations. Anyway. Once again, this is AC2GS, so before we call it a night with my segment, if anyone has any closing comments or statements or questions, this is a good time, so just hit that push to talk button. Okay, I will assume everyone is somewhat talked out as far as it comes to me, so I'll remind everyone once again, that if you want to contact me through email, if you can't get me on the radio, you have some questions you'd like answered. Those are mailbag type of questions. We used to have loads of them back in the old days. Not too many mailbag questions anymore. Or if you have topics you'd like to hear discussed, occasionally we have that. Or we like to offer puzzles. It's not that easy to find interesting, engaging science, technology puzzles. That serve as an opportunity to discuss some aspects of science and technology, brush up on it for all of us. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some YouTube or website about a space-related or NASA-related story and give his 2 cents worth, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I have a link page. A lot of very interesting articles. Those links will be available for the foreseeable future. So any old time you want, just type into your browser Roy, my first name, Romeo Oscar Yankee, my call sign, roy.alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com, and that'll take you to the link page. And as always, I want to remind people that I stream the Glen Oaks repeater on the Internet, so if you have a browser, a cell phone with internet access, but not a radio to listen to the repeater, you can just go into your browser and type technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the audio stream of the Limark repeater. In addition, I always want to remind you, Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive of technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. They are available at his website, which is amateurradio.tv. So keep that all in mind. Be safe, people. I'll be back around 11. And now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2M.
Yes, Jim.
Wesley, you want to say something?
Try the station there, Roy. Stand by.
Yeah, I mean, do we still have a few minutes?
Yeah, we have a few minutes. I don't want to take too much time out for Paul, but yeah, if you have something short, we can do that.
That was the time when the Dick was still alive, and I was telling about the electromagnetic wave that doesn't radiate in the free space. And also I would like to say a few words about the Brewster angle.
Okay.
Brewster angle is polarization angle. It is the angle of incidence at which light in particle polarization is perfectly transmitted through transparent dielectric surface with no reflection. When unpolarized light is incident angle, the light is reflected from the surface and is perfectly polarized. We see polarization in our eyeglasses that allows us to see better when we're driving, let's say. But light is electromagnetic wave, that rule applies to any frequency of electromagnetic wave. So scientists were making a simple experiment. They were taking a dielectric surface and they were directing light to the surface. And light was unpolarized, so it was it was propagating in the possible direction, and then when it hit that angle, usually about 52 degrees, the light comes out polarized from that surface. So we were to have, at the end of the dielectric, let's say the dielectric is 3 feet long, another the reading device that would be directed to that surface at a Brewster angle would be able to receive that. Okay, so now, wave that is not propagating in the free space. Well, we have a near field, and we have a Fresnel zone, and then we have a far field. In the near field, we may say coils behave like a coils of the transformer. You have an air transformer, you can actually induce the AC voltage from one coil to the other. When you have, when you spread them apart, then you have a less of the chances to induce that voltage. Okay, so if we take an electromagnetic wave and we direct that wave to the dielectric surface, we may have a chance to have the reflections, as I said. But that also has a very much similar behavior to the behavior of the wave in the waveguide. So, let's say you had a walkie-talkie in your hand, you transmit, and then you switch off your radio, went home, and the very next morning you wake up, and you think, what happened to that wave? But the wave is still traveling. When you have a piece of the waveguide and you put the electromagnetic wave into that waveguide, and on the other end of that waveguide, let's say 3 feet long, you're reading how much, if you have a power, yes, you do. you can receive that and load it to the load. But if you switch off your transmitter, your wave is traveling nowhere. It disappears. There is no wave. And now we have the interface. The interface is made usually between conductive medium and the dielectric. That's one type. So that means you have a slab of dielectric, and then you have a piece of foil on it, or beneath it. Then the second type of interface, which would be a special form of the waveguide, is that you have a two dielectrics. One is lying on the other, 3 feet long, or 10 feet long, or 100 feet long. And then the space between these two dielectrics becomes, even though they are two-dimensional, it becomes a perfect highway for the wave in the TM mode. The only thing is that those two dielectrics must be of different material. So the dielectric constant of each one of those dielectrics must be different. And if we have a piece of foil 50 feet long and we have air about that foil and the foil is lying on the floor, we have also the interface. This is a similar thing to that what was done by Gobo. It is being called Summerfield Gobo line. When Summerfield in 1907 was making with Dr. Zenek was making the experiments, they had a wire and the wire was coated with dielectric, and the wave was traveling not on the wire and not on the dielectric, but on the space between wire and dielectric. That was that is easy to be repeated and is everywhere in the literature, so you can have ability to send energy over one single wire, but it's not going over wire. It's going in that space. Now, Dr. Zenek was experimenting with different kind, exactly the same kind, but a little bit different looking like interface. There was a long piece of foil and air above it, and the two-dimensional space was the making the highway for the wave. But the thing is that wave has to be directed in the Brewster angle. And it doesn't really differ from that what Gobo and Summerfield did. And then we have a partially conductive medium, which is earth. And then we have air above the earth. And in the low frequencies, you can actually send electromagnetic wave in that highway. And the wave is traveling, obeying all of the curvature of the earth, the mountains, the lakes, the seas, and the oceans. Any questions? And to Xia.
Well, Wesley, it's not that I have any questions. We kind of covered the Zenek wave, Brewster angle, G-line. There was a guy who had a variation on the G-line. The G-lines and the variations, not terribly stable, don't go very far, not very productive as a technology, because you don't really see that anywhere. The guys that you know in Texas who are working with Zenek waves, every so often I check back generally and hear absolutely nothing. So, interesting ideas. You've discussed them before, and I haven't found anything new on the subject in the ensuing years. And like I said before, when the guys down in Texas actually report on something useful, I'd be more than happy to discuss it.
No, I wanted to point the guy who was who was doing that was Dr. Corum, under the supervision of two other scientists. But what I was trying to point is, we can make the Zenek wave is known to the science in frequencies of light as a polaritron and plasma. And there is plenty of applications, commercial applications that are being done right now. But I was trying to point that that wave that is coming from Maxwell equations, the synthesized wave, in TM mode, you cannot see it in the air. It doesn't propagate. It propagates in the near field. But when you have a proper angle of direction of that wave goes to the interface, and that's how global line works. And the other proof of it is that you don't have a wave in the waveguide when you switch off your transmitter. That was like 6 years ago when I had that discussion with Dick, and he strongly opposed. Do you oppose to and to exist?
Well, first keep in mind that Dick was a knowledgeable electrical engineer with 60 years of experience behind him. I'm a kind of physics hobbyist. Dick didn't quite know what to make of it. I tried to explain it as best I could in my own little words. I hate to kind of repeat myself from a couple of years ago, but Zenek waves are kind of fishy things. A lot of times you'll find actual professors who bracket it by saying the so-called Zenek wave. Other people describe Zenek waves in many ways as a theoretical construct of putting in certain variables in wave equations and Maxwell's equations. I do not believe in lossless Zenek waves. I didn't, I don't, I will probably continue not. It doesn't make any sense to me. It didn't make any sense to Dick. It doesn't seem to make any sense to most electrical engineers or physicists. It's a very narrow field. I don't think anything's going to come of those guys in Texas personally. We've talked about those guys in Texas in particular at least 3-4 years. They haven't released anything useful. I think they will continue to not release anything useful because I don't think there is anything particularly useful. So if and when something new happens that isn't very esoteric and quantum mechanically related, that could be vaguely similar to Zenek waves but not quite, that's a different thing. So when someone figures a way of putting across a high-power RF field from point A to point B that's, 1,000 miles away with that no loss, then come back and tell me, and I'll be thrilled to try and figure it out. Until then, it's make-believe to me.
We can measure the losses. Okay, fine. There are different names of the same. You don't have to call it Zenek wave. It depends on the frequency of the Yakov wave, where you have a polaritron, a plasma, surface plasma. Depends which frequency you're talking about. And we can measure the losses when we go to the first square law. And my question to you, if we're talking about the waveguide and we're talking to the free space, does the inverse square law apply to the waveguide? And how?
No, it doesn't, because the wave is not extending into three-dimensional space. It's extending into a cavity and reflecting back on itself. So you're limiting the expansion. The whole point of the inverse square law is you're isotropically radiating into three-dimensional. We'll move away from 4D space-time into just X, Y, and Z planes. And geometrically, as you go out in a sphere, the power rating at any one point on the surface of the sphere goes down by the inverse square.
Good answer. I agree with that. So we have a Zenick wave, resonant surface wave of chiral interfaces, surface wave of gyroscopic interfaces, nonlinear wave, surface plasmon polaritron, Dyakov surface wave, and optical some statics. All of them work on the same principle. Interface. An interface is a special kind of waveguide. So, the question is, you have 50 feet of the waveguide, and you have 50 feet of free space. What would be the difference at the end of the waveguide comparing the free space with 1 milliwatt of power? And Trixia.
Offhand, I don't know the loss of different modes in waveguides. I'm just saying that it'll be less than in free space, obviously, and that's why I also have problems with things like the Zenick wave, where, you know, sometimes you kind of describe it as lossless. It goes from A to B without any loss. Sometimes there is loss. But, you know, it's 1026, Wesley. I really want to get full on.
Okay. I do thank you very much for the chance of me talking to you. It is not that you see some value in this. It is what technology does with that. Waveguide has almost no losses for that 50-feet piece of waveguide. And electromagnetic wave in the free space is being ruled by inverse square law. So you can have 100 watts at one side and 2 watts at the end of it. Versus the waveguide, you have 100 watts and you have 98 watts at the end of it. So that's the difference. If we're talking about distance, interaction.
Okay, again, don't know the particular loss of waveguides. I'm sure it depends upon the type and the mode and other factors. That requires an actual waveguide. Presupposing that you can somehow get the radio waves to believe that the interface between the surface of the Earth and some level above it is an intrinsic Earth-based waveguide, you know, I don't think that that's going to happen. But again, let's leave that for some other night so that we can bring Paul back on, okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. So once again, Paul, WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
KC2GS, WS2N. Very good. Okay, we'll do this. Let me start with a very good story that the Hubble Space Telescope is back in operation. I was glad to read that. I've been following it for the last, I guess, 6 weeks. Quit working about 6 weeks ago. And they finally picked... The main problem was this payload computer. You know, there's a series of computers and stuff on the Hubble. And they have one called the payload computer. And that apparently failed. And so now they have to bring up a backup, which they have on that. They weren't sure if it was going to work. They really never used it. I think they tested it once over the years. But apparently it did work out for them. It's now actually doing science and starting to take pictures of galaxies and whatever it's been doing for the last 31 years. Probably almost 2 million different pictures over the years have been sent back on Hubble. So the scientists are going to have a ball with this. Our leader here that passed away
two marches ago, Dick K2RIW, considered himself a Hubble hugger. He thought it was one of the best scientific instruments that NASA ever put into space. It got the most from that than any other instrument that they put up there. He really didn't want it to fail. They knew eventually it would because, you know, in 2011 the shuttle stopped flying, so it could not have any more service missions. You needed a shuttle to get to the Hubble. Hubble's a lot higher in orbit than the space station, and also it was a different inclination. So you really need a space shuttle to get there, and that all came to an end on STS-125 when that was the last service mission to the Hubble, and that was in 2009. At that time, I remember them saying that they were hoping that they can get another 7 years out of it. You know, they would have been happy to make it to 2016 or 2017. Their goal was to try to make it to when the, at the time it was called the Next Generation Telescope, now it's called the James Webb Space Telescope, would eventually be put in the Lagrange Point 2, a million miles away from Earth, or four times the distance from where the moon is. And but now that thing's been delayed year after year. It is now scheduled to launch this October on an Ariane 5 rocket. So hopefully NASA and, you know, got it space. They're the ones that control and operate Hubble. I get their wish to have both telescopes in space at the very same time. You know, one of the things they would like to do is take a picture of the same spot in space, you know, a galaxy or whatever it might be, with both instruments, and then compare the two. They just would love to do that before Hubble actually eventually fails. They were hoping to get the 7 years out of it, and on that last mission, they spent, I think it was five different missions that went up to repair the Hubble over the years, five different service missions. And they would change out things like computers and gyroscopes and even solar panels over the years, changed all the optics many times. Each time they went up, they always got an improvement of sometimes, you know, a 10-to-1 ratio. So now it's back in operation. No more service missions to it. The last service mission, they did attach a docking collar to it in case there was a point where some, you know, maybe the Dream Chaser or something would be able to dock with it, service it again, or if not, maybe they could send an unmanned, you know, if they're going to destroy it eventually and burn it up, maybe they would send an unmanned vehicle to dock with it to help control it and burn it up over the South Pacific. But that never happened, and I think someday, you know, when the gyros fail or the, you know, the electronics, communications between Earth and Hubble eventually fail. Who knows what, you know, when that will be. But then, you know, sooner or later, you know, it's on borrowed time now. But, you know, 31 years on a machine that they never thought they would get all those years, still ticking. This is WS2N. Any comments before I move on? Well, okay, we'll move on to Perseverance. Perseverance is the 2020 rover that was built and put onto Mars. It landed there in February 18th of last year. You know, it was launched in 2020 in July, and then this past February it landed. And it successfully deployed the Ingenuity helicopter,
and a lot of attention is being paid to that. But now Perseverance is finally getting to start doing some of its important science missions. There's a bunch of flat-looking rocks. They look like slate rocks that are out there. And they're going to test the core boring system. Actually, well, they're actually going to... Not really a test. They're actually going to do this. The idea is to core bore a sample. You know, instead of the old system, they would just, you know, drill into a rock, and then they would take the scoop and put the dust in, of that rock into a analyzer on board the Curiosity, the older system, the rover that's still up there. That was the old system. Now what they're going to do is core bore. You know, they have a better drills. They're going to actually take a core sample in this rock, maybe about, you know, it looks like a little bit bigger than a half inch in diameter, almost 3/4 inch. And once they do that, they have this carriage on board, and they're going to put the robotic arm will take the core sample and put it into this carousel system, and then that will they'll store it for a period of time in the rover. It will be sealed. They have these like test tube type of gadgets, very expensive test tube gadgets lined with gold and everything. It's a perfectly sealed system. You know, they're going to make sure that no other contaminants can... There are 43 test pieces on the rover. I think they're going to use about 30 of them. And then what they'll do is they'll take them, and they're going to leave them in certain spots as the rover drives around over the years. And someday in the future, I guess maybe within, looks like 4 years from now, maybe, let's see, probably about 4 years from now, they'll send a rover, they'll launch another rocket, and a small, very small rover will be able to land on Mars and then drive around and collect all these, let's call them test tubes, and put it in its own carousel. Bring it back to the vehicle where the rover landed, and install all these, say, 30 different test tubes into a solid rocket that will be built by Northrop Grumman that's presently being developed, and it will put it onto that and eventually shoot that into orbit in Mars orbit, and that will eventually dock with another orbiting spacecraft that the European Space Agency will eventually send into orbit around Mars. So that will be the return vehicle. It will dock with that. There will be a transfer, again, with this carousel of all these test tubes into the orbiting spacecraft, and that has a large engine on it that will ignite. It will leave Mars orbit and head back to Earth. And then at some point, I think it's around 2030 or so, I forgot the date of the year, but at some point, it will eventually arrive back to Earth. It has a heat shield. This orbiting spacecraft will send this vehicle through the atmosphere, Earth's atmosphere, at 25,000 miles an hour with parachutes, and it will eventually land in Utah, and hopefully they'll be able to pick the same test tubes up that within 2 weeks they'll be drilling the first one on Mars. They're all core boring pieces, so that's the plan, and they're now well on the way of doing this, and this rover will last for years. It has a nuclear-powered system. It's a radioisotope thermoelectric generator that's producing up 109 watts every hour. That, in turn, is
charging the these batteries. They have got to get 3 or 4 44 amp hour batteries, lithium ion batteries. They're charging these things. These batteries, of course, are what runs the rover day and night. And it's all based on this over, little over 100 watts that they're getting. Hopefully it'll run for years. The last one has the same system, Curiosity, same radioisotope thermal electric generator. And thing's been riding around on a planet of Mars since 2012. And here we are coming up to its 10th year anniversary next year. Any comments or questions? Before we move on, this is WS2N. Okay, I guess not. I talked about this launch that was going to happen on the last night. Sure enough, it successfully got off the ground from Russia. What it is, it's another module, a big module, that's going to become part of the International Space Station. Well, the Nyoka module, 43 feet long, 14 feet diameter, and successfully launched from Russia, well, you know, not really from Russia, from Kazakhstan, and that's where Russia launches most of their rockets from. And apparently it did have some problems, from what I understand, for the first day. Initially it was okay. Open up its solar panels, that was okay, communications was okay, but a few things were not okay. Needed to put it into its proper orbit, and that didn't happen. Apparently there was a computer foul up between the Nyoka and the mission control, and anyway, they worked it out. Well, I read today that they corrected that. Well, the new module is now scheduled to actually dock with the space station. It's supposed to happen a couple of days ago, but it's been delayed to, I believe, Thursday now for the docking. So a couple of things have to happen first before this thing docks. They need to remove an old, smaller module from the space station called the Pirs module. It's on the Russian side. It's facing down toward Earth, what they call the Nadir, location on the Russian side. So they need to clear that. So the last Progress or cargo mission that Russia sent up did its normal job of sending cargo up, and they eventually loaded up with stuff to get rid of all the trash. But in this case, they're going to leave it attached to the docking module on piers, and then they're going to separate the piers from the International Space Station itself. They didn't want to do that until they knew Nyoka was going to have a good chance of docking with the space station. They were leaving well enough alone. I mean, as it was, Pierce is also used for EVAs, for the cosmonauts' spacewalks. So eventually, they will disconnect that within a couple of days, and then those two units, the Progress and the old Pierce module, will drift away from the space station. Progress will light its engines off, and that will eventually deorbit over the South Pacific Ocean and burn up. But that will leave the opening for Nyoka to dock. NASA's going to help out with investigating and making sure that the O-rings and everything that are on the receiving end on the International Space Station are in good shape after over 20 years of this thing being attached. And, you know, you disconnect something after 20 years, and sometimes it don't look good. They're not expecting a problem, but anyway, to investigate it, they're going to use the Canada robot arm tube, which is a big Canada arm that's 57 feet long, that's attached to the space station, that will investigate the
the port, make sure everything looks okay. It'll go in there real close. It's got a good camera. See fine details, real fine details. You might remember when they had problems with the shuttle when the Columbus module burnt up in 2003. Any space shuttle that went up to the space station, they would take the cameras and look at fine details on the bottom of all the space shuttles. Probably see if there was a human hair out of place with these things, with these cameras. So that's what they're going to do, and if everything checks out, and they think it will, this coming Thursday, they will attempt to automatically dock. When I say they, the Russians will try to have it autonomously docked to the space station. That was part of the problem, too. The course boat with a K, docking system, which is really a couple of antennas, one on the space station and another one on the equipment that's going to be docking in this case, Nauka. That's attached to the front end of it, and that antenna didn't initially deploy, but from what I understand, they've worked that out too now. So they're going to try to do that. If it doesn't work autonomously, the Russians have a system built in where the cosmonaut on board the station could actually grab a hold of the controls inside the space station. And he starts looking at all the readings that he's looking at, and it's as if he's inside the docking vehicle, whatever it might be, either the Progress or Soyuz crew vehicle, whatever it might be. He's able to dock it manually. So you could remotely do this in case that autonomous system does not work. So once that's docked successfully next Thursday, they'll be able to open up the door on it, and they're going to get a lot more room inside the space station. Right now you have two cosmonauts who are able to sleep inside the service module, very large module that the Russians have. That's their biggest one, which is like a big room. I mean, they have sleeping quarters, they have bathrooms, they have eating, and that's, when they have an interview after a crew comes up and docks, with the Russians, they always have an interview. They'll put all the astronauts, whoever might be up there, it might be 6 or 10 people, and they'll photograph them. That's the module. That's also 43 feet long, 14 feet in diameter. So it's the same size as this thing. So essentially they're going to be almost doubling the size of the Russian side of the space station. So that should be pretty interesting. More room gives them a chance to have another cosmonaut up there. They do have one extra sleeping quarters or crew quarters on this Nauka unit. This module is going to be docked. They also have another bathroom, and that's always good to have. Right now you have two permanent bathrooms on the space station, and now you have three. So all the people up there, right now you have seven. I guess you could have at times a regular crew of eight once this thing is in effect. I don't know if they'll do that, but they will have that capability. WS2N, any comments, questions?
Bob, WA2MHL. Yes, Bob, WA2MHL. What's happening with...
You said a couple of words. Good audio, but then you dropped out. Looks like there's no PO on it. Bob, we'll try it again. WA2MHL.
Yeah, Paul. I was asking him.
What I heard was, yeah, Paul, I was asking, and then you were gone. You might want to
double check if you're 136.5 hertz PL is on. That's what it sounds like to me, but I really don't know. I'm not even sure if you're coming through on direct or if you're on Echo Link or something. I'll try it again, Bob.
JHR with the query. Name is Joel Juliet Oscar Echo Lima.
Oh, okay, Joel. Yeah, go ahead. Well, maybe Bob's checking his rig out for now. Make sure he's got all the buttons set, connections made. Back to you, Joel. Hello, Joel. I didn't get your call, so. I know it's Joel. Back to you. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
WS2N, K2JHR. Question that I have, now that we have two billionaires that have been in space, or not space, but what you say would consider space, what do you see as happening here on beyond this, other than billionaires going up into near space, and those people that can afford to buy into this being able to do so? Do you see this as being viable to those of us who are not multi-billionaires, or those of us who cannot obviously afford to put out that kind of money? What kind of viability do you see in this particular program? K2JHR.
Okay, Joel, it's going to be a long time before prices ever come down to the point where, let's say, somebody in the middle class could afford it. You know, like you're going on a cruise or something. You know, reminds me of I watch these documentaries about these trains. There's one documentary where they're driving through the mountains of Spain, and there's only like about on the train, and everybody's paying $5,000 to go on this train, and you know, luxury food and everything. That's what this reminds me of, you know. Right now, it's only the rich, like you said, billionaires going to be going up. Eventually, you'll get it to the point where, you know, just your average millionaire will be able to do it. They're looking at $250,000 each for a ticket eventually. And, you know, right now they don't have a tremendous amount of these rockets. You know, they have the one new ship, and I think they're building another one. And then Virgin Galactic has the Unity that he went up on, and I believe they're building another one. But they have long-term goals, like France wants to set one up in England, where he could have a runway for his White Knight carrier jet to carry him up. One there, another one in Italy. These are long-term goals. So, you know, I would imagine eventually you would have to have like three carrier jets. Right now they have one. And then you'd have to have at least three space planes. So maybe more than that, you know, you're going to need to work on one now and then. So his goal is to have this happening, like, you know, a couple times a week. Sending up, let's see, Virgin Galactic sent up six people. So eventually they want to send up eight, you know. But all at these ridiculous prices that, You know, and it is expensive, you know, to build these things and to launch them. There's a lot involved, so they're going to have to charge just a wild amount of money. Eventually, you're going to have a situation where suborbital flight isn't going to be good enough. Virgin Galactic will say, well, okay, we're going to fly, you know, from here to there, you know, from this runway to another runway, and from here to London or something. They'll try to, you know, come up with something like that. You know, I know where, you know, that kind of travel, you know, somewhere down the road might eventually become common. And when it does, then, you know, you'll be able to have people to pay for it. Look at the Concorde. Concorde, they used to fly 2 times the speed of sound. Back then, I think there was paying, you know, thousands of dollars to do that. I think the first flights were like 13,000, and they eventually get down to 5,000 or something toward the end. So, you know, the average person, I guess, someday would be able to afford it if they kept having, you know, more and more supersonic flights. Now, that thing was traveling like 2,000 miles an hour. This flight, that both these flights that went up were only going around 2,400 miles an hour. The only difference is they were going up straight up, and they were, you know, vacuum sealed 100% and also capable of flying without an atmosphere. So I guess that day, you know, it will eventually come. Ultimate goal of, let's say, Jeff Bezos, you probably read he wants to eventually put a space station, massive space station, they call it the L5 location, but out in space. He thinks, you know, in 100 years from now, you're going to have millions of people in space manufacturing stuff. He wants all manufacturing to leave the Earth. So he's got these way out thoughts and, you know, to do something like that is, you know, I think we'll have to be around for another 100 years or so. The other guy, he doesn't have any long-term plans, like, as far as I know, about building bigger rockets to go into orbit. That's Branson, where Jeff Bezos does. He's building a rocket almost as big as the Saturn V now. You know, it's called the New Glenn. He's building that down in Florida. That will be orbital. So they'll get away from these suborbital things at some point. I think the first flight of New Glenn is early 2024, maybe. Yeah, he claims a little earlier, but let's call it 2024. That will be another one of these reusable deals where he plans on landing on an autonomous ship, similar to what SpaceX is doing with their Falcon rockets. They land on the autonomous ships out at sea for reusability.
That time complete.
And we'll see. This rocket that Bezos is launching is the New Shepard. It flies with the BE-3 engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. That will eventually be the second stage, or maybe even the third stage for the New Glenn rocket. So they're getting plenty of experience with that right now. This was the 16th flight of a New Shepard type of vehicle, by the way. So, I don't know. Philosophically, I guess eventually, years from now, many, many years, decades and decades from now, I guess Jeff Bezos will have his dream of some massive, space station to manufacture stuff up there. I don't really see that happening, but you never know. That's his goal, and eventually Richard Branson will be probably sending people from one location on Earth to another with his suborbital flights in different locations. And I guess Elon Musk will eventually have a colony on Mars. I mean, these are their long-term goals. Anyway, back to you, Joe. I'm a little long here, but what are you going to do? Sorry about that. WS2M.
Hi, WS2N, H2JHR. Just two questions that I have on this. A, do you see any military possibilities on this, specifically any adversaries of this country being able to use that type of technology against us? Or do you see any possibilities that if indeed you have the weightlessness that you do have, can that weightlessness be used actually in a manufacturing capacity where you're actually able to produce products where you don't have to worry about any gravity effect, and you can actually produce things in a much quicker fashion and possibly a much less expensive fashion than you have here on Earth? WS2N, K2JHR.
Okay, Joe. Yeah, well, they know they can make certain crystals that you can't make here on Earth in orbit. They've done that. Certain useful crystals. Something called Zyban, I think it's called Zyban with a Z, which is some type of high, very high bandwidth fiber optic cables. You know, you can set up a factory just for that stuff. Because you can't make it on Earth. It needs zero G to cure properly as they make it. And I'm sure there's going to be thousands of other products that could be done. Yeah, that's Jeff Bezos' goal, you know, to do things like that. It's NASA's goal, too. They've been thinking about that for years, to try to produce stuff in space. And then, you know, but to make it economical, that's the other key thing. Eventually, they would like to put massive solar panels up in space, you know, miles and miles square, and then you would take that and beam it down with microwaves to keep it on Earth somewhere and convert that to electricity. So, I mean, that's manufacturing electricity. So, yeah, you're right, 100%. Military stuff, well, I mean, they're all... what's good is, like, Virgin Galactic has this... called Virgin Orbital, and that's also by Branson. Virgin Orbital has this big 747, they named it the Cosmic Girl, and on the bottom of the left wing, they attached they call it Launcher. Launcher is the name of the rocket, and it's a three-stage rocket. Liquid oxygen and liquid kerosene, RP-1, rocket propellant 1, in these three Newton engines that fire off the 747, and they're able to put, you know, a couple thousand pound payloads into orbit, but they've done it twice so far. So you take different companies like that, Virgin Orbital in this case. You take the Electron rocket with Peter Beck, you know, from Rocket Lab, also launching smaller versions of, you know, rockets into space for payloads. And new ones coming up. Astra is another one. Firefly is another one. You can imagine you have, you know, 10 companies launching small payloads into space. And what that will do for you, let's say, like you said, there's a military problem. You know, some adversary of us decides to shoot a couple of our satellites out of orbit. You know, because that capability is there now. You know, we have now sent satellites, something called the MEV, MEV-1 and MEV-2 that Northrop Grumman has built, gone out to geosynchronous orbit. And capture the satellite and hanging on to it and put it into a different location because it ran out of fuel. So, you know, we have that capability, and our adversaries are going to have it too. They'll be able to fly right up to a satellite and blow it out of the sky. The good news is, with all these launch companies that we have existing now or under development, you'll be, you know, say they knock out a half a dozen satellites, don't matter. We could launch them very quick right after that and put our satellites right back into orbit. The military wants that. SpaceX has that capability to do as well on a larger scale. They might, you know, they might send up, you know, 20 or 30 satellites at one time. You know, that's what I see. Therefore, it becomes like, you know, a drawer. You know, it wouldn't pay for any adversaries to knock our satellites out of space because they know inside of no time we're going to have them back again, you know. You want to try it again? Go ahead, knock them out. We'll send up more. Back to you, Joel, WS2F.
All right, I appreciate it. appreciate the information. Makes a great deal of sense. Absolutely does. All right, I appreciate it. Now stand by and listen on the side. WS2N, KT.